Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on poison drops in the federal Senate right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, our latest President George Bush said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, or the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in employment. And it's certainly not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. It's not in public business, and it's certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that we cash in on our inheritance and learn how to collect these benefits of the old covenant contract and to collect those benefits in real wealth, things like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called property. Instead of trying to collect it in credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for our free General Law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the archives page, and then you can download that free General Law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we've been talking about this thing of poison drops written by Zach Montgomery, and he said back in 1886, looking at the census statistics from 1850 to 1880, he said, listen, the more money you spend on public schools, the more crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violent criminals, and unemployment you're going to get. That's exactly the opposite from what our politicians have been telling us over the last 50 years, at least over my lifetime. Every time there's a problem in public school, we need more teachers, smaller classes, and spend more money, and that'll solve the problem. We've been doing that, and the problems get bigger and worse. Doesn't solve the problem. Johnny can't read, and we can't figure out why. Well, Zach Montgomery had it scoped out clear back in 1886. He said there is an endemic reason or cause, which is in the public school system, that causes crime, poverty, insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment. It's built right into the public school system. Now, if you want to solve these six social problems, you eliminate public school, and while it won't eliminate all of it, it will reduce it by anywhere from 33 to 800%. Now, that's what we've seen so far. Now, let me take a look here at this thing of insanity and suicide. Listen to this. Mr. Fred W. Wines, who is the special census agent, in his preference to the statistics of crime, pauperism, and insanity, for the year 1880 presents the following synopsis of the number of the insane, idiots, blind, and deaf mutes found in the United States during the years 1880, 1870, 1860, and 1850. So he gives the numbers here in a table, and as remarked by the agent, the total population for each of these years was as follows. In 1850, the population of the United States was 23 million people. In 1860, it had grown to 31 million. In 1870, it had grown to 38 million. And in 1880, it was at 50 million. So, in other words, while the population doubled in 30 years between 1850 and 1880, the number of defective persons returned is nearly five times as great as it was 30 years ago. So while the population grew 100%, the defective people in the society had grown by 150, or five times as great, or five times, it's 500%. Population grows 100, and your defectives grow by five times, 500%. Why? What caused that? Now, during the past decade, or since 1870, the increase in population has been 30%, but the apparent increase in the defective classes has been a little more than 155%. So while the population grew 30%, the defective class, that's just in 10 years now, from 1870 to 1880, grew by 155%. Again, five times as much, a little over five times. So what Montgomery discovered here was that the rate at which these social ills are growing is growing exponentially. While the population grows in one period of time by 100%, your defectives grow by five times. When it grows by 30%, it grows more than five times. Five times as much. So with each period of time, and it's been that way since the 1880s until today, and it's still growing exponentially. Here in the United States, we have more people locked up in jail than we have farming. We have more prisoners than we have farmers. Now that's kind of a phenomenon. Why do we have 2 million people locked up in jail? And why is it that here in America, where we pride ourselves on all this public school, that we have so much crime and more people locked up per capita than anybody else in the world? Nobody in the world has as many people locked up per capita as we do. It wasn't always that way, but it is that way today. So something pretty dramatic has occurred, wouldn't you say? Now, as shown elsewhere, it's also painfully apparent that our criminals have increased almost in the exact ratio with the increase of our insane, idiotic, and other defective classes. And commenting on the astounding growth of crime, insanity, pauperism in the United States during the last 30 years, the special agent says this. He said, "The interest and importance of the inquiry into the number and condition of the defective classes and of the criminal and pauper population arises from the fact that these are burdens to be borne. They are drains upon the vitality of the entire community. When we consider the growth of our population and our material resources, we are in danger of forgetting that there is another side of the picture. It is startling to know that of 50 million inhabitants, over 400,000 are either insane, idiots, deaf, mutes, or blind, or inmates of prisons, reformatories, or poorhouses. If to these we add the outdoor poor and the inmates of private charitable institutions, the number will swell to nearly or quite half a million, or 1% of the total population." So in 1880, we had a defective rate in the United States of 1%. Now, the agent says this is a drain on the vitality. This is the head of the census of that era. They called him the special agent. This is in 1880. Now, if 1% is good, Wouldn't 2%, 5%, or 10% be even better? If you take a look at autism, every autistic child is a drain on the entire community. It's a person who is never going to be fully productive in the productive capacities. And it's a person that in all probability will have to be taken care of. So in 1930, we had zero autism. By 1943, we had a handful. As time progressed along, it grew until today, one out of every 68 children in the United States has autism. That's one out of 68. From zero to one in 68. Well, let me ask you this. When the rate grows to one out of 10, or one out of five, or one out of two, do you think that that's going to be better for us or worse? Is that what we're after? Would it be good if we had 4 million people in prison instead of 2 million? Would it be good if twice as many people had diabetes as currently there are in the country today? Or would it be better for us if we had half as many diabetics, half as many people in prison, and half as many people with autism? Because the trend's headed in the wrong direction. And it was headed in the wrong direction from 1850 on. And when this guy Montgomery brought it to our attention, nobody got excited about it and said, gee, let's do something about it. Nobody's done anything about it from that day to this. And so you're at a point in time today where the economy cannot support all of these freeloaders, all of these burdens laid upon us. Add to that all of the people that come into the country illegally, and they're taking jobs from the people that live here who have all been to college and been educated in our public school system and don't want to work anymore. And that's another problem that we have. See, once you educate people in public school, they don't want to work. They want to get paid, but they don't want to work. And so in order to get the work done that needs to be done, you have to go down to the border and put out a help wanted sign, which is accompanied with a no trespassing sign. So on the one hand, we don't want these people in here, but if you don't have these people come in here to do the work, Americans aren't going to do it. Nobody that goes to public school, certainly nobody that goes to college, is going to go out and pick lettuce. You're not going to have anybody that's got a PhD working at the Tyson poultry plant, you know, processing chicken. So somebody, if you're going to go into McDonald's and have a hamburger, somebody had to kill that cow, bleed it, process the meat, grind it up, put it in the truck, and haul it to you where you're at. Somebody back in the back room there had to take that hamburger patty out and cook it for you. And you're not going to find people with college degrees doing that kind of work. And so then you either have to have the teenagers do it, and then you can't have that because that's child labor. We're opposed to child labor, so we can't have our kids do it. So then the only thing that's left then are the people from south of the border. The Canadians, you know, they're just like us. They're not going to come down here, cook your burgers, and process your chicken. Now he goes on to say that we italicize and fully endorse the closing words of the agent, in which he says, we cannot begin too soon to prosecute too vigorously the inquiry into the causes of the prevalence of these evils, which are like a canker at the heart of all of our prosperity. Nothing can be more important than for us to ascertain at the earliest possible moment the rate at which they are increasing and the means of arresting their growth. The subject is obscure, says the agent, but in the study of it it may also be said, we have our finger on the pulse of the nation. And while, as suggested, we fully endorse the said italicized words, we're not entirely disposed to endorse the declaration that the subject is an obscure one, especially to those who will carefully examine the statistics embodied in this report and then study them by the light of a few common sense principles. If it is true that a child brought up in the way that he should go will not depart from it when he is old, Who will venture to deny that there has been something radically wrong in the bringing up of a generation which so readily and so rapidly betakes itself to the paths of crime, or which either ignorantly or otherwise brings upon itself the constantly increasing maladies of idiocy, insanity, and kindred evils? In our 1880, public school property was valued at $211 million. Our receipts during that 1 year for public school purposes reached the enormous sum of $96 million. There were gathered into our public schools 9 million children, and out of our public school treasury we are paying $55 million in the way of salaries to some 236,000 public school teachers in order to prevent crime and save the expenses of paying peace officers and building city prisons, county jails, and state penitentiaries. And behold the result. Our towns and cities swarm with policemen. Our prisons, workhouses, and reformatories are crowded almost to suffocation with thieves, robbers, and cutthroats, while gilded crime goes unpunished, and moneyed malefactors without number strut our streets with heads erect, spit upon the law, laugh justice to scorn, and fatten upon their ill-gotten millions, while multitudes of their wronged and ruined victims are lodged in almshouses, lunatic asylums, or seek refuge from so sad a fate in the still more horrid doom of self-destruction. Hey, this almost sounds like the headlines coming out of Congress relating to Goldman Sachs and the bailouts that you see going on around you, and Obamacare and so on. The white-collar criminals, who are all educated now, all have degrees, spit on our laws, bankrupt our nation, and while the rest of us over here are struggling to make ends meet and pay our taxes and make our mortgage payments, these guys are making obscene profits at our expense. And then what makes it worse is they bankrupt themselves and the nation, and then they come to the Congress, and the Congress gives them the bailout money at our expense to bail them out. The cause of our problem has to be bailed out, and the rest of us over here have to tough it out on our own, don't we? Well, it isn't something new. It was going on before. And this is the guy that put his finger on the pulse of it. It's public education. Now, there's something to be said about this thing of compulsory public education. In other words, we now have laws in all of our states that require you to educate your child in public school. Now, what do you think about free choice? What would you think if a guy said, I don't want to send my kid to public school, I want to send him to the local Catholic school, or I want to send my kid to the local Lutheran school, or maybe the guy is really off the wall and he says, I want to educate him at home. I want to educate my kid at home, homeschool. What would be wrong with that? Would that bother you in some way? Well, it bothers the public school administrators. It bothers the politicians, because now we, that is, you and I, if we want to send our kid to parochial school, we have to get permission from the local school board. If we want to educate our kid at home, we have to get permission from the local school authorities. They have to approve it. And in one state, Pennsylvania, your kid has to be tested every so often. You have reports that you have to send in, just like, you know, you were working for the state. What do you think of that? Compulsory public education. The anti-parental school system, when we dissect it and analyze it, looks something like this. If we would wish to ascertain the exact character and properties of the waters of the Pacific Ocean, we would not undertake to analyze the whole ocean, because that would be an endless task. But we would take up at most a few ounces of this water, and after making a thorough analysis of it, we would announce the result as indicating the properties and character of the waters of the Pacific. So it is, if we would make a careful and reliable analysis of the essential principles and elements which go to make up what is known as the public school system. If we were to undertake to subject to an analytical test this whole system with its entire paraphernalia of teachers, pupils, parents, school directors, school teachers, school books, school funds, and school houses as they exist throughout the country, we should become amazed and bewildered at the magnitude of our undertaking and would probably abandon the enterprise in despair. So let us take from this very large mass of school material a small quantity of its essential elements, just enough to be handled with ease and examined with care, and we shall be the better able then to see what is the character of the ingredients which go to make up this system, in order that you, good reader, may not accuse us of unfairness in our selection of the particular sample to be analyzed. We will allow you to choose your own material. You pick it. Then you cast your eyes around you among your friends and neighbors, and just name for us two of the very best, purest, most intelligent, highly educated, and reliable men of your acquaintance. Let them be men of your own religion, of your own choosing, and belonging to the same political party as yourself. In a word, let them be two men to whom, in preference to all others in the world, you would be willing to entrust the guardianship of your beautiful little girl, your daughter, and should it please God to take you and your mother away from her during her years of childhood. Now these two friends of yours, whom we shall call Friend A and Friend B, we shall take it for granted that they are the very best material to be found in that great mass of voters who control by their votes the destinies and shape the character of the public school system as it exists in your city today. Now let us further suppose that these two model men and neighbors of yours, men that you have picked, should someday come to your house and address you like this. They would say, "Now, Mr. C., we are informed that you are the father of a bright, beautiful, and intelligent little girl, now about 7 years old, just the proper age to begin her education. And we feel quite anxious that she should be properly educated, and to tell you the plain truth, we are afraid that if we leave that decision entirely with you, her education will be neglected. Now, here is what we propose to do. We propose that we, your two best friends, together with you, yourself, shall all enter into a written contract binding ourselves during your daughter's minority to contribute annually a certain percentage upon the assessed value of your house, your property, which shall constitute a fund for the education of this, your little girl. But it must at the same time and in the same contract be stipulated that it shall at all times be in the power of a majority of us three to select the teachers and the school books for your child. Should you, against the wishes and without the consent of the majority of us, take your child away and send her to some other school, you must agree to forfeit, should we choose to exact it, not exceeding $20 for the first offense and not less than $20 for each subsequent repetition offense thereof. You must also agree and bind yourself in advance not to withhold your assessment, even should you withdraw your child from the school of your selection, because we should in that event need the money for the education of other children. Now, tell us, good reader, would you ever consent, while living and in possession of your reasoning faculties, would you entrust such a power as this over your infant child, your girl or your boy, to any two men in existence? Would you not spurn such a proposition as the above with indignant scorn, come from what source it might? Now, we may here remark in passing that it surely could not be better or better the matter should these supposed friends and neighbors, in consideration of this proposed outrageous betrayal of your parental trust and right, even offer to perpetuate a similar wrong against their own children by turning over to you, the insulted father, a corresponding share in their children's parental authority. Now keep in mind, boys and girls, you have already done this. And you have not entrusted the education of your child to two of your best friends. You have not entrusted the education of your children to friends who belong to the same religion and the same political party. You have entrusted the education of your children to nameless, faceless bureaucrats that you did not elect, cannot remove, and have no control over or say-so over the education of your child. You've already done that. Now, if you wouldn't have given your child to two of your best friends who belong to the same religion and the same political party, why would you give your children over to people you don't even know, who don't belong to your religion, don't belong to your political party, and don't share the same views, political and religious beliefs that you do? Now, you've done that. But, of course, the question arises, well, why? And yet, good reader, this miniature picture, which we have just drawn of the public school system, presents that system in its very best possible aspect, because we have represented you, the father, as still allowed to retain in your own hands one-third of that parental jurisdiction and control, which the God of nature requires you to exercise over your child, while the other two-thirds are to be entrusted to two of the very best men in your entire community. But under the public school system, as it is by law established, instead of retaining in your own hands even so much as a third of your parental authority, you retain only an infinitesimal fraction thereof, where there are, as in San Francisco, tens of thousands of voters. Each father divides his parental authority into tens of thousands of equal fragments, retaining but one of these fragments for himself. After all, this is democracy, and the majority rules. Now, while the great bulk of this authority, instead of being lodged, as in the case above, supposed in two of the very best men to be found in the city, rather it is now scattered around and broadcast amongst tens of thousands of people, some good, some bad, and some indifferent. This parental authority is now gobbled up and wielded by every rough and every rake who is allowed to vote. And this is what they call our great American free school system. This is, in fact, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto: free education for all children in public school. Those who attempt a justification of this monstrous usurpation of parental authority never fail to entrench themselves behind the hackneyed and much abused maxim that the majority has the right to rule. But boys and girls, there are some things in which the majority has no right to rule. For example, the majority has no right to select for a man his religion. The majority has no right to choose for a man his wife. The majority has no right to select for a woman her husband, who is to become the parent of his or her children. Now, the teacher of a child is simply a person who, for the time being, acts as a substitute for his parents. But if a majority has no right to select the principal, that is, the parents, then what right does the majority have to select the substitute, the teacher? In other words, if a majority has no right to force a man or a woman who aspires to become the father or mother of the child, then to whom he or she subjects on the grounds that such a spouse, by pernicious teachings or bad example, would corrupt the child or the children of such marriage or poison their minds and hearts against the objecting party. then in the same or in the name of consistency and common sense, what right has this same majority to accomplish the self-same and even worse result by selecting as the teacher to take the place of both parents, a person who is distasteful to them and who may imperil and destroy the health, the lives, the honor, the virtue, and the affection of their children as well as their own peace of mind, without in any way being held responsible to them or either of them for his conduct? Put another way, what if you objected to the morals of the school teacher or the morals of the school district or of the curriculum being taught? What would you say to that? Well, that's precisely where you're at today. You don't have any say-so or input into the curriculum, the books, or the morals or the teaching, or the morals of the teacher who's teaching your children. Now, as old William Bendix used to say, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. Well, let me give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. In the Law Hour, an editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. We're reviewing the book Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, written in 1886 by Zach Montgomery. If you're interested and want to get a copy of it, it was printed by St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Again, that's St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Now, this is a very obscure book, first published in 1886. It's not going to be an easy one to find. Not impossible, just not easy. So, I would start by calling BraveNewBookstore.com. BraveNewBookstore.com, you can find them online. They have a telephone. They're modern and up-to-date. The telephone number is 512-480-2503. Again, that's area code 512-480-2503. You'll find them in Austin, Texas. Brave New Bookstore. 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, and their zip code is 78705. That's where I go. One more little trick for you there. If you go to a used bookstore and you tell them, here's the book I want, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, written by Zach Montgomery, they'll put that into their computer. And then if there's any copies, you know, used copies laying around someplace, they might find it in South Africa. I found one time in Cape Town, South Africa. And another book that I was looking for came out of Long Beach, California. And they're hooked up to some 500,000 bookstores worldwide. So if you're looking for a particular title and it's obscure, out of date, rare books or something like that, you'll probably find it at a used bookstore online or from BraveNewBookstore.com. All right, now let's take a look at what happens in public school that causes crime. What's going on in the public school that causes crime? A voice from San Quentin, California's educated convicts, all the younger criminals can read and write. Two more penitentiaries necessary to accommodate Massachusetts public school pupils. California public schools, the high road to the penitentiary. And how the one serves as a preparatory department for the other. The following is from Resident Director Lieutenant Governor Johnston's biannual report showing the condition of the California State Prison, the state prisoners for the 2 years ending June 30, 1877. This report under the caption of Education says, Turnkey's Table Number 7, showing the educational abilities of the inmates of the prison, gives the number who can read and write at 985. Those that can read but not write at 24, and those that can neither read nor write at 309. If we consider the number of Chinese and Indians in our prisons who can neither read nor write, and deduct them from the whole number so as to match our white and Negroes against the same in other states, it will be found that ours possess the advantage in a large degree. In fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write. So the Lieutenant Governor of California back in it was 1877, June 30th, 1877, made this report. He said, all of the younger convicts in the penitentiary can read and write. As if to say, wow, we have arrived. But nobody has ever put two and two together until this guy, Zach Montgomery, started putting the statistics together and said, hey, wait a minute. The more people that we have in our society that are educated in the public school system, the higher the crime is. The more criminals, the more poverty, the more insanity, suicide, violence, and unemployment we have. Could it be that it's caused by these public schools? Now, it is true. It is true. That just because there's a correlation doesn't mean that the one necessarily follows the other or the other is caused by. I was watching Nova the other night and they were talking about this thing of vaccinations. It was called the vaccination war. And they pointed out that just because your child went in and got a series of vaccinations, and then a week or 10 days later, your kid comes down with autism. That does not mean that the vaccinations caused the autism. You could have. But that doesn't necessarily prove that the vaccinations were the causal factor. Now, those people whose children came down with autism, They said that it did. They said, you know, my kid was fine, took them in for their routine shots. They got their shots, and a week later, 2 weeks later, you know, the kid comes down with autism. So it would be natural to ask the question, well, could there be a correlation? Is there a particular vaccine or something that's in some vaccine or the combination of vaccines? I mean, it would certainly trigger investigation, wouldn't it? Now, of course, the medicos and the pharmaceuticals, they'd say, oh, it doesn't require any investigation. There's just no correlation and we don't believe it. I mean, that's like saying, well, autism doesn't exist. Now, we can see by the results that autism exists. We can see that there are prisoners in prison. And furthermore, as the Supreme Court noted in the Yoder case in 1972, when they asked this question, how many Amish people do we have in prison? And the answer in Wisconsin, at least, was none. How many of these Amish people are on welfare? The answer is none. How many of these Amish people are unemployed? None. That's the exact goal of the state's educational system. They said, the reason that we want people to go to public school and to become educated, and that we feel that we have to require by mandatory education laws because we want to eliminate crime, poverty, and unemployment. That's the purpose. But in Wisconsin, when they went out and they looked in all of their prisons, unemployment rolls and welfare rolls, they found that every single person had been public educated, but that none of the Amish had been public educated, and furthermore, none of the Amish were in prison, none of the Amish were unemployed, none of the Amish were on the welfare rolls. So the Amish have accomplished exactly what it is the state wants to accomplish, and they did it without public education. Now the state wants to accomplish these laudable social goals, and they have educated all of those children and everyone who is unemployed, on welfare, or in prison, has been public schooled. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody that goes to public school is going to end up in the penitentiary, because they don't do that. Not everyone that's public schooled is going to end up unemployed or on the welfare rolls. But it's kind of like cancer. John Wayne smoked, and John Wayne died from lung cancer. My grandmother smoked. And my grandmother did not die from lung cancer. But when we take a look at the broad number of people who do smoke, we find that smokers get lung cancer more often than non-smokers. So we would conclude that smoking doesn't necessarily cause cancer, but we find that smoking among those people who do contract cancer is at a higher rate than those who don't. So therefore, if you don't smoke, your chances of getting lung cancer aren't eliminated, but they're much less. So if you don't send your child to public school, his chances of staying out of prison are much better than if you send him to public school, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if you send him to public school, he's going to end up in prison. But his chances are 8 times greater. 8 times greater. Same thing is true here with autism. Now, I took a look at this and I said to myself, now they've conducted tests, they've looked at children in various groups. What they haven't done is to go over to some place in the world like Nepal or Tibet or in the heart of the Belgian Congo or something and find a group of people, maybe in the Amazon forest, a group of Indians who have never been vaccinated in their entire lives. Even going back several generations, there's no vaccinations. And then ask the question, how many of these people, what's the ratio of autism in these groups of people? And I'll bet you the answer will be zero. I don't care what they eat and smoke and drink and et cetera, but I think you're going to find that they will have zero autism. Now take a look at the people who have been vaccinated anywhere in the world, and I think you're going to find autism, and I think you're going to find it in great numbers. And that'll tell you whether or not vaccination is connected to autism. See, they went over to Denmark. They have a better system over in Denmark, keeping track of everybody and their vaccinations. And they looked at the DPT shots, and they said there's no difference between the thimerosal and the DPT shot in Denmark, and the rate of autism per person or per capita in Denmark as it is in Japan or any place else in the world. And so they said, well, it's not the thimerosal that causes autism. But in 1930, we didn't have autism, and we didn't have any vaccinations. In 1932, we mandated 2 vaccinations. Today, we mandate 35, and we find that the autism rate now has gone from 0 to 1 in 68. The one thing that is consistent here in the United States concerning autism is that all of the people in this country that have autism have been vaccinated. All of the people who are in our penitentiaries have been to public school. All of the people who are in our welfare lines and unemployment lines are all educated. Hell, all of you people out there listening to me right now, you're unemployed, and you've been public educated. Now, a sample of our own population, the Amish people, they have not been educated in public school, and none of them are unemployed. Zero. To find an unemployed Amish man, you're going to look a long time. You just start looking for an Amish guy in the welfare rolls or in prison, you're going to look a long time. I'm not saying there aren't any there. There surely must be one or two. But the rate is so low that it's practically non-existent. Let me show you one more example of this as you're looking at a broad number of people trying to ascertain what's causing this, or what could we do to eliminate it. Take circumcision as an illustration. In China, where circumcision is not practiced, people there come down with cancer. You know, they get colon cancer, breast cancer, they get lung cancer. Well, there's a particular type of cancer called penile cancer. Penile cancer. In China, if 1,000 people get cancer, 14% of them, 140 out of 1,000, will get penile cancer. That's the rate that it comes out at statistically. Now, go to the Jewish people anywhere in the world. Doesn't make any difference where. Just pick them out anywhere. And they practice circumcision. Here in the United States, in the 20th century, there were 2 Jews who were diagnosed with penile cancer in 100 years. 2. Both of them had articles written about them in the Journal of the American Medical Association. That's how rare it is among Jews. Not unheard of. A Jew could come down with penile cancer. Now, what that would tend to show us is that circumcision doesn't quite eliminate, but virtually eliminates penile cancer. So look around the world, and when we see that kind of phenomenon, then the rest of us sit there and say, well, gee, maybe if I practice circumcision, I could reduce my chances of getting penile cancer. Another illustration comes from the diabetes rolls. Now watch how this association works. Over the past 20 years, here in the United States, the consumption of soda pop has doubled over the past 20 years. From 1990 to last night, we've doubled our consumption of soda pop. Isn't that special? At the very same time, in the same 20-year period, the incidence of diabetes has doubled. Now, the Coca-Cola and the Pepsi-Cola people would say that does not prove that Coca-Cola causes Coca-Cola or Pepsi or soda pop does not necessarily cause diabetes. But don't you think that it would be worth looking into to find out? Now, I would propose a test. Let's see if we can double the consumption of soda pop between 2010 and 2030 over the next 20 years. Let's see if we can double the consumption of soda pop. And at the same time, let's watch diabetes and see if it doubles also. Now, wouldn't that tell you that it may not be the soda pop, but maybe there's something in the soda pop, sugar maybe, that causes this diabetes? I just thought I'd throw that out for your consideration. Because I know right away somebody's going to say, well, just because, you know, people that go to public school are 6 times or 8 times more likely to end up in prison doesn't mean that public school causes it. But Zach Montgomery comes to a little different conclusion. He says not only is there a correlation, there is an exact cause and effect connection. He says there's a connection. I think the guy hit the nail on the head. He's got quite a little story here to tell. He goes on and he says this. He said, the turnkey table number 3 shows that the number of Chinamen in the state prison is 197. Now, if we deduct this 197 from the entire number of convicts who can neither read nor write, it leaves just 112 who can neither read nor write against 985 who can both read and write. Then again, from this 112, there remains still to be deducted the Indians whose number is not given in the turnkey table. But the most startling revelation contained in the above extract is found in the concluding sentence, which says, in fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write. That's key. Now listen to this. In fact, among the younger convicts, all of them can read and write. Now, of the younger convicts, as appears from the turnkey's table number 6, there are some 253, but 21-year-olds or under, while there are 831 30 years and older. But while our young state is making such rapid strides in the way of forcing her boys first into her anti-parental schools and then into her penitentiaries, her great exemplar, Massachusetts, it would seem, is not neglectful of her laurels. The regular Boston correspondent of the San Francisco Morning Call, under the date of November 16, 1877, says, quote, the rapid progress of knowledge peculiar to the educational system of this state has led to the erection of 2 more state prisons, one of which is for women, and was successfully opened a few days ago. The number of wicked females who knocked for admission being 44. Present indications point toward the rapid filling up of this new institution in a few months. Now, we are constantly told by the friends and admirers of our anti-parental educational system that it is much better and more economical for the state to expend money for schools and schoolhouses than for jails and penitentiaries. Now, I've heard that quite often, that it would be cheaper for us to build more schools and more colleges and spend that money that we're now spending on prison and to spend that money on the schools. If, in fact, public education prevented crime, it would make all the sense in the world. But if, in fact, our thesis is correct, that the public school is causing the crime, well, then the more we spend on public schools, the more crime we're going to have and the more prisons we're going to have to build. And that's exactly what's been going on. That's what we actually see today. The more money we spend on public schools, the more crime we get, so therefore we have to build more prisons. No one has taken a look and said, gee, I wonder what would happen if we cut our soda pop consumption in half. Would then the diabetes level drop by 50%? See, nobody's ever thought of that. Nobody's ever talked about it. What if we were to cut smoking in half? Would that cut lung cancer rate? You know, we've kind of come to that conclusion here in this country, and we've come to the conclusion that smoking causes cancer. We have not come to the conclusion yet that soda pop causes diabetes or that soda pop consumption increases the risk of diabetes any more than we have come to the conclusion that public school causes crime. But wouldn't it be worth looking at, seeing that when we look at the statistics and the facts, that's what's actually occurring right out there on Main Street? Furthermore, it didn't start under the Clinton administration either. Hell, this has been going on, you know, for 150 years. Now, taking the foregoing figures as a basis of calculation, it would be very interesting, and it would doubtless lead to most important results, if some admirer of our present educational system, who is a good calculator, would make an estimate in dollars and cents of the amount of money saved to the state of California every year by that kind of education, which is sustained at a cost of more than $2.5 million a year, and which sends to the state prison its hundreds of beardless boys, while total illiteracy, which we all lament as a great evil, sends not so much as one solitary boy to that popular institution. So here, as recently as 1877, we find that the illiterates in the state penitentiary are practically non-existent, while all of the people that are in there can read and write. And so he sits there and says, well, why don't we start figuring out what the cost of illiteracy is and the cost of prisons, and that if we had more illiteracy, we might have more, and we might have more people who stay out of jail than are actually going to jail. Now, that doesn't say that we should be illiterate now, or we shouldn't learn to read and write, but it's a matter of, well, who should teach this reading and writing and arithmetic? Where should this education transpire? Through a surrogate teacher who is controlled by the political process, or should it be conducted by moms and dads, people who have an interest in their own children? Now, when I was a kid, we used to have a wide variety of religious groups in the little town that I grew up in, Corbell, California. And in this little town, the Mitchells were Mormons. Mitchells were Mormons. And, you know, then the Fernleafs over here were Pentecostals, and the Gordons were Nothings, and, you know, other people were other religions. Now, we all went to public school. And some of the students that went to public school there in Corbell ended up in prison. For instance, the two Fernleaf boys ended up in prison. The Mitchells didn't, and the Gordons didn't, but some of us did. Now, that doesn't mean that school, that is, the school in Corbell, caused the Fernleafs to go to prison, but it sure as hell didn't keep them out of prison, now did it? And the interesting thing, when you take groups of people like the Mormons, if you let the Mormons educate their children to their beliefs and standards in their own homes, and you let the Catholics and the Protestants and the Jews and everybody else do the same thing, they will teach their morality, their politics, their themes and systems of morality to their own children. That's what the Amish are doing. We don't agree with Amish theology. None of you listening to me right now agree with Amish theology. My point is that the Amish have succeeded in eliminating crime, poverty, and unemployment. And they suffer a lot less insanity, suicide, and violence. They're not illiterate. They can read and write. They're learning from their own families and their own teachers and their own little groups. If it works for the Amish, could it work for the Mormons, the Protestants, the Jews, and the Catholics? Do we really need public school? Hey, I'm out of time. Let me give you a reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.